This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Yeah, we're trying to respond to this, but cholera is something that once it's out of the bottle is very hard to get back in. That's why it's been very frustrating to be facing the challenges we have as far as access and some of them imposed by the authorities themselves.
That's Justin Brady from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Port Sudan, talking to me about the spreading cholera outbreak in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, members of the U.S. Congress look at Washington's relationship with Ethiopia, and violence increases in the occupied West Bank. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Democratic Republic of Congo is expected to hold elections in December 20, 2023. To discuss this important political event, we have in studio VOA's Idriss Fall from the French to Africa Service. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Idriss.
Thanks, Yehia, and good evening to all your listeners.
So, Idriss, the country's electoral commission has announced President Félix Tshisekedi will be seeking re-election alongside 23 other candidates. Your thoughts?
Now there are four of them join Moïse Katumbi, who is another candidate of former governor of Katanga, the former owner of the soccer team Tout-Puissant Mazembe, and there are some other Martin Fayulu who told that he won the election in 2018. And there is this new Nobel Prize also, Denis Mukwege. There are a lot, but more than 20 candidates.
So how do you see this thing playing out? We have, like you said, Martin Fayulu and then Denis Mukwege, the Nobel laureate. What do they bring to the table, and how do you see the election coming along?
First of all, it's very complicated because DRC is huge. And many of those 20 candidates, they don't have means to be able to make campaign in the whole countries. Mm-hmm. Few of them can do it. The others, they are staying in one region or in one town, so it looks like it's going to be tough for most of them. This name, I'm just quoting Denis Mukwege, Moïse Katumbi, Martin Fayulu, Joe and Félix Tshisekedi are the biggest one, and Matata Ponyo and all those people. They can make campaign in the whole country, but it's going to be tough, I think.
And Idriss, one key political figure has yet to make his intentions known. Joseph Kabila, he was president for, 18 years until Tshisekedi took over, and he holds substantial political, military, and business clout.
Well, since he left power, he never wanted to get involved again into politics. I even spoke yesterday to one of his counselors, Marcelin Tshisambo, who was former governor of South Kivu, and he told me, Idriss, we are in our fields, we are cultivating oranges and whatever, and they are looking the things to, but they are not involved. For the time being, they are not involved at all.
So as an observer of DRC, it's not like your prediction, but how do you see this thing wrapping up when election starts?
There's one thing sure. For the time being, there had been one people killed during the campaign close to Moïse Katumbi. And the problem is here, they don't have a runoff. It's one.
Just one time.
One time. And the guy who come ahead become president.
With the most numbers.
Yes. And if you have 23 candidates, it means that President Tshisekedi has an advantage because he's in power. So, and who knows?
Is the Eastern DRC any part of the issue?
It will be, because security there is huge, and the government decide to get rid of the East African forces who came there to fight the armed group. The government decided that the UN must leave the country. So the insecurity in all Eastern DRC is an issue because it had been there 30 years and nobody had solved it.
So December 20, we will know who is the victor.
Well, but if you know very well Congo, after the election, there comes serious business because people will contest.
Idrissa Fall from the French to Africa Service. Welcome for your input.
Thank you, Yahed.
Justin Brady, the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs for Sudan, says at least 161 people have died from cholera in Sudan since September, with another 5,178 suspected cases. In talking with VOA's, OCHA's head of office in Port Sudan, Brady starts out by describing to me where and when the outbreak started.
The cholera outbreak started here in September in areas in the east, which are concentrations of internally displaced from the conflict that started here in April between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. Those areas also host a large number of refugees from neighboring conflicts, as well as the host communities there. It has now spread to 9 states overall. And those include Khartoum and South Kordofan states, which are heavily impacted.
Okay. So, Justin, what is the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs? What is it doing about the situation?
Yeah, working with our health and water, sanitation, and hygiene partners to mount a response. That has been inhibited by access challenges, as I mentioned, in Khartoum and South Kordofan that have been affected by conflict, but also by bureaucratic impediments imposed by some state authorities.
So at least 161 people have died from cholera in Sudan and almost 5,178 suspected cholera cases. So how is that going to be handled?
Yeah, we're trying to respond to this, but cholera is something that once it's out of the bottle is very hard to get back in. That's why it's been very frustrating to be facing the challenges we have as far as access, and some of them imposed by the authorities themselves. You know, the overall situation in the country is very, very difficult since the war began and has intensified in recent months and in the west of the country. And right now we are less than 40% funded, and water, sanitation, hygiene, and health, while some of the better funded areas of work are still well underfunded what they need. So in some ways we're responding with one arm tied behind our backs. Yeah, surely. Here in Port Sudan, what was a very small port city is now overwhelmed by the number of internally displaced who are here, as well as the UN and NGOs who have concentrated here. The infrastructure, like many of the cities where IDPs have gone to, is really by the authorities themselves. You know, the overall situation in the country is very, very difficult since the war began and has intensified in recent months.
So, Justin, who is in control where you are? And are you worried for your security?
The government, the Sudanese armed forces are in control of Northern State and Port Sudan where we are. We do have staff in other areas of the country, obviously. Look, this conflict has moved in many different directions. So it isn't that I'm immediately worried about our here, but that could change. And we certainly have contingencies in place, as we must in these sort of situations. I spent 7 years in Somalia, so this is sort of rote, you know, par for the course in these sort of environments where we're trying to respond to the people in need in the midst of conflict.
Justin Brady, the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs for Sudan, he talked to me from Port Sudan. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs, and a whole lot more. The head of a U.S. congressional panel on Africa says, a stable Ethiopia is good for the Horn of Africa and the rest of the world. But U.S. lawmakers are concerned about the status of the cessation of hostilities agreement signed a little over a year ago after Ethiopia's two-year war. VOA's Carol Van Dam has more.
John James, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa, made a pointed reference to Ethiopian leader Abiy Ahmed, who received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019 for ending a long-time territorial dispute with neighboring Eritrea, but in 2020 ordered a military offensive on regional forces in Ethiopia's Tigray region, which he said he did in response to an attack on barracks of the National Defense Forces in the region.
The high expectations that began in 2019, including awarding a Nobel Peace Prize, to expand and deepen bilateral relationship with Ethiopia can still be met. But recent challenges by leadership in Ethiopia, and challenges including greater conflict in the region and global economic shocks, have clouded Ethiopia's journey.
Those challenges included the killing of civilians and a large number of rapes in the Amhara and Tigray regions, as well as fighting in the Oromia region. Ethiopia's national forces began fighting in the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a regional ruling party, in November 2020. The two sides signed a cessation of hostilities agreement a little over a year ago. This year, however, has seen outbreaks of violence between government forces and militia groups in the Amhara region. James noted Ethiopia is at risk of defaulting on its nearly $30 billion external debt and looks to the West for money. He was speaking at the subcommittee's hearing last week on U.S.-Ethiopia relations.
The American taxpayers are tired of being used, and we hope to have some of our questions answered here today.
VOA reached out to the Ethiopian embassy about the accusations against the government made at the hearing, and on Tuesday it responded, saying in a statement, the Ethiopian government remains fully committed to restoring peace and enforcing accountability across the country. Mike Hammer, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn, testified that the U.S. government is aware of ongoing human rights violations. He said, however, overall violence has dramatically decreased since the cessation of hostilities deal was signed.
We have been focused on the agreement's implementation while impressing upon the Ethiopian government the importance of dialogue and negotiation as a path to resolving ongoing violence in Oromia and Amhara. And we regularly engage with the Ethiopian diaspora to explain U.S. policy, encourage civil discourse, and foster reconciliation among all ethnicities and regions.
Sarah Jacobs, the panel's ranking Democrat, agreed the hearing was timely, given alleged ongoing human rights abuses and continued fighting in parts of the country.
War in northern Ethiopia and ongoing conflict have triggered a massive refugee and displacement crisis, even setting a world record for displacements in a single year. We've also seen the disruption of crops and increase in food prices, causing millions in the country to rely on food aid, which was temporarily paused due to its diversion.
Tyler Beckelman, Deputy Assistant Administrator of the Africa Bureau of U.S. Agency for International Development, testified that food aid resumed on a one-year trial basis after receiving commitments from the government that the distribution would be tightly monitored. The aid was cut off for 5 months earlier this year after USAID found much of it was being diverted by government forces. He also said the ceasefire deal was a much-needed reprieve to the millions of people affected by the war. Yet many of the agreement's commitments have yet to be fully realized, including Ethiopia-run courts for transitional justice.
USAID stands ready to support the implementation of a transparent, victim-centered process that contributes to truth and reconciliation. It's also critical that Ethiopians themselves lead the fight for justice and accountability, which is why USAID supports local civil society organizations that monitor and advocate for these principles.
In October, the International Commission on Human Rights in Ethiopia reported that civilians continue to be killed and women raped in conflict areas. Sarah Miller of Refugees International, who recently returned from a research trip to Tigray, tells VOA that people are still suffering from hunger and gender-based violence, often committed by Eritrean and Amhara forces.
We've heard reports of it from all different fighting forces. What we know and what was really shocking, because I've worked in a number of different conflict settings, is how widespread it was. And so we're not just talking about a few isolated rapes here and there. We're talking about widespread, large numbers of women that were not just raped, but they were gang raped in front of their families. Fathers would be told to rape their children. If they refused, they were killed. Really gruesome stuff.
As for the stolen food aid, the Ethiopian embassy told VOA in its statement, quote, "We have taken steps to prosecute members of the government security forces and government officials who committed human rights abuses and participated in food aid diversion." It said rebuilding Ethiopia based on the ideals of truth, justice, peace, and reconciliation is essential as we move toward lasting peace. But it is essential to understand that these processes do not happen overnight, end quote. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
Today, the center of Gaza's second largest city, Khan Yunis, has seen fighting as Israeli troops widen their offensive in the southern part of the territory. The assault in the south has displaced thousands more Palestinians and worsened dire humanitarian conditions. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says more than 17,000 Palestinians have died in Gaza since the Israeli offensive began 2 months ago in response to attacks by Hamas militants on Israeli communities. About 1,200 people died in those attacks, and Hamas militants took about 240 Israelis and foreign nationals hostage. Aid agencies say some humanitarian aid is trickling into Gaza, but the supply remains far below the amount of food, water, medicine, and fuel that came before the conflict. Israel's government this week agreed to allow in more fuel, but the supplies remain limited because of concerns Hamas fighters would use the fuel. Also today, two international human rights groups said Israeli strikes that killed a Reuters videographer and wounded six other journalists in South Lebanon in October were apparently a deliberate and direct attack on civilians. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch said the airstrikes should be investigated as war crimes. Their findings were released simultaneously with similar investigations by Reuters and the French news agency AFP. Israel officials have said they do not deliberately target journalists or other civilians. Violence by Israeli settlers in the West Bank has escalated since the war with Hamas began on October 7th. According to Palestinians. This has happened even as the Biden administration steps up pressure on Israel to stop settler violence by ordering a U.S. travel ban on extremist settlers involved in attacks. Henry Wickens visited the scene of some of the recent clashes and has this report from the Palestinian town of Karawat Bani Hassan in the West Bank.
In the olive groves of Hawat Bani Hassan in the West Bank, Palestinian villagers escorted VOA to the spot where Ahmed Assi, a 41-year-old father of six, was killed during clashes with Israeli settlers just 3 days earlier. After the fighting died down, his brother says villagers found his car abandoned in the middle of the road. He says someone from the town spotted his car in the location where the clashes occurred, so those who had been with him went down to search for him in the last place they saw him. He says that's where they found him dead, estimating it must have been about 4 hours earlier. The settlers came from a settlement across the valley. On a map in his office, the mayor of Hawat Bani Hassan points to Israeli settlements surrounding his community. Ibrahim Arsi says another member of the community was killed by settlers in February, but they've exhausted ways to seek justice for that killing with the Palestinian or Israeli authorities. The mayor told VOA he calls on all citizens worldwide, especially those from America and Britain, to intervene and prevent Israel from perpetrating massacres and hold them accountable for the actions of its settlers under its protection, adding that the settlers target those who lack any way to protect their lands. In recent weeks, the Biden administration has been putting pressure on Israel to stop the violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians. On December 5th, the US announced it would ban extremist settlers from obtaining US visas following repeated requests to the Israeli government to control the violence. In the cycle of violence, 31 Israelis, including children, have been killed in the West Bank by Palestinians this year, according to UN data. Rights groups say fatalities caused by Israeli settlers have doubled since the war began and that settlers are better armed and more aggressive. Bill Van Esveld is a researcher for Human Rights Watch.
In previous problems with settlers, there would be one guy with a handgun, but now there's a group of guys and they all have M16s. And that the threats are much more severe and immediate. Like, you need to get out of your house and leave your community within 5 days.
In a written response to VOA, the Israel Defense Forces officials said the IDF and civil administration are taking all necessary actions to maintain the security of all residents in the towns and villages in the region. The IDF said it broke up the clash that killed Arsi, but the local mayor said the IDF was supporting the settlers only. As for Arsi's oldest son, aged 15, he says he couldn't believe his father was dead when he learned the news. He says the settlers made him take the burden of responsibility for his family at such a young age. The Regional Council of Israeli Settlers did not respond to VOA's request for comment. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Harat Barney Hassan in the West Bank.
The United States Congress is urging strong coordinated U.S. response to tackle conflicts and instability in the Sahel, which it describes as dire as it examines its policy towards the African region. VOA's Ignatius Anor reports from Capitol Hill.
Exacerbating conflicts and instability in Sahelian nations like Sudan, Niger and Chad, and West Africa's Guinea, Mali and Burkina Faso prompted a congressional hearing by the U.S. Foreign Affairs Committee on Africa on December the 5th. The committee invited senior U.S. government officials to answer questions and provide a pathway to what it sees as a dire situation in the Sahel. John James, chair of the U.S. Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa, questioned the U.S.'s commitment to bring in peace in Sudan, for example, citing funding to Ukraine to be more than 20 times the non-military assistance to Sudan.
Ukraine has a population of approximately 43.79 million people. Sudan has a population of approximately 45.66 million people. Yet the non-military assistance that has gone to Ukraine is $12.4 billion. And the humanitarian assistance to Sudan is $620 million. I've heard things like we need to do everything we possibly can. But what I see is you have almost identical population sizes, but 20 times the commitment financially to the people of Ukraine than the people in Sudan.
Molly Fee, Assistant Secretary at the U.S. Department of State Bureau of African Affairs, responded, saying the Sudanese people affirmed that the U.S. has been a true ally in trying to end the current turmoil.
My contacts with the Sudanese people tell me that they believe that we are the best friend to the nation. It is not Russia or China who showed up to try and help end this conflict. It was the United States. We are perceived to be disinterested and care about the civilians and care about the stability of the state. That is not the position of other partners in the international community. The strength we have is that they want to have a partnership with us and they want our help to resolve the conflict.
Celeste Walanda, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs at the U.S. Department of Defense, says extremist organizations are capitalizing on weak governments in the Sahel and are now approaching countries in the Gulf of Guinea.
In the short and medium term, we will support African-led counterterrorism operations to disrupt the most acute terrorist threats, with a particular emphasis on those targeting U.S. interests. In the long term, we will emphasize bilateral security assistance to African defense and security forces in order to build their own homegrown capacity to counter these threats without excessive external assistance.
Robert Jenkins is assistant to the administrator of the USAID's Bureau for Conflict Prevention and Stabilization. He says the donor agency is working to empower young people in the Sahel with the education and skills needed so they do not fall prey to extremist groups.
The U.S. has been the third largest contributor to the Global Partnership for Education, a multilateral organization providing education services in several countries across the Sahel. Peace and stability in the Sahel requires bringing peace and stability to Libya, which has served as a source of and destination for weapons and armed fighters.
The U.S. Foreign Affairs Committee on Africa says Russia is exploiting the instability within the Sahel via its paramilitary Wagner group to make profits and score geopolitical influence. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department is appealing to Congress to confirm much-needed ambassadors to the African Union, Nigeria, Niger, Somalia, Djibouti, and Gabon. Ignatius Anno, VOA News, Washington.